Hi, this is Dick Cavett with Adam Shartoff, and I'm sitting here in the Film Wax Radio Glorious Studios. Does that do it?
Hello, everybody. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio, and you're listening to episode number 288 of the podcast. Thank you so much for streaming and downloading this show today. Thank you so much. It's Friday. Well, as I record this, Friday, I've been a little bit slow. Normally, I try to get an episode up a little earlier in the week, but this week was, I don't know, it was near impossible. I have been traveling earlier in the week and just backed up. I'm doing a big event tonight. I mentioned it in the last episode. I'll mention it again. If you're listening to this and you live in the New York City area and it is Friday, you should come out to Brooklyn, to Williamsburg, to the venue known as Videology, which is at, I think, 308 Bedford. It's at South First Street and Bedford, just blocks from the L train and blocks from the JMZ. It will be at 6:45. We'll open doors, and we're going to have a live podcast. It's called the Montclair Film Festival Edition. What I'm trying to do are live film live podcasts, and I'm trying to do some of them around film festivals. And the actual Montclair Film Festival takes place starting May 1st. That's next week. But this is sort of a buzz event that I came up with. And we're having a number of people from the festival come tonight, including the executive director of the festival, Tom Hall, who until recently was the senior programmer down at the Sarasota Film Festival, and now is at Montclair. And also we're expecting a number of filmmakers, including Jessica Edwards, who has a new documentary about Mavis Staples. It's called Mavis. It's been acquired by HBO, which is great. And so Jessica will be there. We're going to also have Morgan Neville, who a couple of years ago won an Oscar for his movie 20 Feet from Stardom. And he's back with a new documentary co-directed with Robert Gordon. And it's called The Best of Enemies, which is the famous kind of centered on the famous debates that took place in, I think, 1968 between Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley Jr. And it's definitely about their rather venomous relationship, but entirely watchable. I mean, not only the documentary, but every, you know, frame of footage that these two guys were in, you can't take your eyes off of them. They were so amazing to watch, and a great, great entertainment value. So we'll have Morgan Neville with that. And then finally, Chad Rossia is going to come. He made a documentary, which is called The Russian Woodpecker, about this huge antenna that was built at Chernobyl. And it was supposed to not only intercept and maybe sabotage communications in the U.S. and around the world, but it was a big, giant failure. It didn't work. And so the main character, this young guy, he's an artist, his name is Fedor Alexandrovich. He has a theory about this. And it's a very scary, very tense film, and you know, it puts you on edge, and it's an incredible, remarkable film. Again, it's called The Russian Woodpecker because of the tapping that this antenna makes that you know radio frequencies would pick up, and it's creepy, you know, and what it was used for or intended for, and what happened to Chernobyl and how it's tied together. So I hope that's enough to pique your interest. So Chad will be here, the filmmaker, as well as, I may as well just announce it, Fedor Alexandrovich will be here as well. And then finally, I said finally before with Chad, but not related to the Montclair Film Festival, but and just as a reminder, all of those films I just talked about are going to be at the Montclair Film Festival. We're also going to have my friend Scott Rogowski, who has been on this show before. He's a comedian. We're going to open with Scott and me having a conversation as well. So that's what the live podcast will look like. Again, if you're free tonight, Friday, April 24th, 2015, at 6:45 p.m., come on down to Videology. Join us, please. And we're going to shoot it, and we're going to also, of course, hopefully if the audio comes out well enough, we'll post that as well. So thanks for that. Episode number 288 of the podcast. Nick Broomfield back on the show. Nick was on a few weeks ago, actually, not that long ago, talking about his repertoire of films that are currently on Fandor. It was great to talk to Nick. We Skyped. He was in L.A., I believe. But this time, Nick is talking to me about his new documentary called Tales of the Grim Sleeper, which is also on HBO. Move over, Jessica, just a little bit to the side there. Let Nick sit down with you, please, because he's got a documentary. It's premiering on HBO April 27th, which is only a couple of days away. So I wanted to get this conversation with Nick up there. Bill Plimpton is a famous Oscar-nominated animator, cartoonist, and his new film, it's called Cheatin', is brilliant. And I, you know, if you look in the credits, my friend Sophia Takal is one of the voices. His characters don't talk per se. They make lots of squeaking and squealing noises and grunts and all sorts of other noises. And so Sophia is the lead female in this film. So she squeaks and squeals and grunts beautifully. Well, very well acted. Shows she has so much experience and talent. And Sophia has been on the show many times, but she's not joining Bill. It's just me and Bill Plimpton talking about his work. And then finally, which I think we'll start with, actually, is my friend Jonathan Howell, who is a distributor of art films. His company is called Big World Pictures, and we're going to have Jonathan up in just a couple of minutes. We kept trying to meet in person, but alas, we could not, so I ended up just Skyping with him. It's a very brief conversation about his films that he's distributing, including works by Eric Rohmer and other amazing artists, so stick around for that coming right up. In fact, I'm just going to say, let's go right into it. I'm going to make it brief because I have a big event to do later tonight, and I have to get to it. I might even try to run in beforehand and see a couple of press and industry screenings because, of course, the Tribeca Film Festival is taking place this week. So that's what's going on. And one of those films might be Applesauce, which is directed by my friend Arnor Tukal, who I have to name legally at least once in every episode, so it seems. So that's it. Episode number 288. Here's my conversation with Jonathan Howell, and then we'll go into Nick Broomfield and Bill Plimpton.
So what can I tell you, sir?
So, Jonathan Howell, welcome to FilmWax Radio.
Thanks. Very glad to be here.
Oh, you sound so close and intimate now. That's nice. Glad you finally, I don't know, I think it's very, very healthy from a therapeutic standpoint that you encourage yourself to come on the show, even though we're doing it through Skype at this particular occasion, and get over your, or whatever the podcast version of Stage Fright looks like.
Facing my greatest fear. But, yeah, so far so good.
Maybe you were actually just being polite and that you're worried about your reputation if you came onto the show.
A little bit, but not much, no. No, not at all.
Okay. Well, tell me about Big World and all the exciting projects that you're working on or that are coming up and that, you know, people should really know about because you're doing God's work after all, Jonathan.
Oh, nice of you to say so. It actually is mission-driven company. It's a nonprofit. Big World Pictures is in a branch off of our original nonprofit established in 2006, The World According to Shorts, which was established to distribute foreign short films in the U.S., films that would never be seen here otherwise, and films of great quality, or so we thought anyway, that we thought would really be of interest and also really an eye-opener and kind of, I don't want to overstate the matter, but hopefully changing, transformative somehow for people who watch them.
You're saying transformative in the sense that it would expose them to a new forms of storytelling, or are you still talking about the shorts in that way?
The same mission applies to the features. We just took a longer form, really. But that's one thing, the form of the shorts, but also the different cultures explored, because the mission was for foreign films, and it still is for foreign films primarily. But we're really trying to represent underrepresented populations, bring them more attention, and really try to develop empathy and understanding for people other than ourselves, for everyone.
So there really is actually a couple of different social messages or goals.
Sure, yeah.
In the context of the distribution of these films.
Yeah, and I think along with all that, we just want to encourage people to watch good films. I mean, that's where it really all started. But these other things are an outgrowth of that we've realized are benefits of watching good films.
But it's also how the company Big World Films, or excuse me, Big World Pictures stands out.
It's one way. I mean, well, being a nonprofit is already making us stand out in a large way because there aren't very many nonprofit distributors, not too many mission-driven distributors, or at least not in that, in the really focused sense.
Not in commercial narrative films either.
Exactly, yeah.
Maybe more so in an educational, institutional documentary type of environment.
Right, yeah, that's more common.
And so, since we got in the broader picture, what about a couple of things that maybe you are working on that are people can expect to see soon?
Well, the soonest would be our film that opened yesterday, Simon Liang's first feature, Rebels of the Neon God. This is a film that we've been working on. In theory, we've been working on it for years, even before Big World Pictures actually became Big World Pictures. Been looking for ways to distribute this film because I was aware it had never been theatrically released in the US, and it just felt like an overlooked gem, that's one of our catchphrases. We like to find overlooked gems, whether they're old or new, and just really bring them to a public that may be waiting for them, looking for them, but doesn't even know what they're looking for until we're able to present these things to them.
Well, how do you deliver that message? Not to get too far off, finish the thought, first of all, like where you mentioned the film, where can people see
Sure.
that particular film since it's already out?
It just opened yesterday at the Film Society Lincoln Center for a 1 week run. It can only stay 1 week, can't hold over. It opened also at the Quad Cinemas downtown, and we're hoping it'll hold over there. Depends on how it does, but I think we should get hopefully about 2 weeks at least out of that, maybe three. And it's also playing in as part of the complete retrospective of Simon Liang's films that opened at MoMA last night in Astoria, Museum of the Moving Image. It'll play next either Friday or Saturday. I think it's Friday that it plays just one screening.
Well, that's a good way to get the message that the film's out there. Screen it at Lincoln Center.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt. Nice platform.
So do you deal with like Dennis Lin?
Yeah, Dennis and Florence Almazini.
Oh, right. Very good. And then at the Quad, who's taken over at Elliot? Didn't he just retire or sell the? What's going on down there?
Well, I've always booked there with Rob Lewinsky, and I knew that Bill Thompson with Cohen Media is also involved, so I got in touch with those guys, and they were more than willing to put the film in downtown.
What do you mean? Cohen Media, isn't that another distributor?
Yes, they do a lot of French films, but other foreign films as well, and actually some repertory titles. They seem to have taken over some catalogs. I don't know specifically how much they have as far as titles, but it's quite a few now. I think their most recent film was Timbuktu, the Abdur Mansa Sakho film, Oscar nominated.
So are you saying is that the Quad is partnering with them?
Link, yes. I believe they bought the Quad and they're renovating it
Oh.
at the end of April. They're closing it down for who knows how long to renovate.
Really?
Yeah,
Huh.
that's what I hear.
Well, why not?
Yeah,
It just kind of.
it's a time-honored practice. I mean, Lincoln Plaza Cinemas has had a distributor or connected to a film, a
Right.
theater, and IFC Center, of course, is
Right,
the
Draft
same.
House is another.
And in a way, Magnolia and the Landmark theaters they're related. So.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're owned by the same parent company.
Oh, interesting. Okay, very good. So it's good to talk to a big time distributor like Big World.
Yeah, big
What?
time, yeah.
I'm not trying to be Patrick, but what is your title there?
Director, I think, is what I usually go by. I sometimes say acquisitions, but I mean, I pretty much wear all the hats, so.
Yeah. Is it just you?
Yeah.
Okay.
And my board. I have a board of directors because
You're
we're
a
a
nonprofit,
nonprofit,
right?
so.
Yeah. Wonderful. And what else have you got coming up, anything?
Actually, very soon, that is this next week, we have two DVDs coming out. One of them is Eric Rohmer's Tale of Winter, part of the Tales of the Four Seasons series. And this has never before been on DVD in the US. It was released in 94, made in 92, and released in 94 here through New Yorker Films. And they put it on VHS several years later, but they never released it on DVD. So this is the first DVD release of A Tale of Winter. The Tales of the Four Seasons are considered by some critics to be among Rohmer's best work. And as you know, we released the summer sale last summer, and it was got great reviews and did pretty well around the country. That was another film that had never been theatrically released, even though it had been around, played around, and even been on DVD before.
Yeah, I'm a big Rohmer fan myself.
I am too.
I think back in the day when people would make fun of
French films, you know, or poke fun, I should say, of French films for having people sit around and smoke, drink red wine, mm-hmm. and talk about love. Actually, they were referring to Eric Rohmer films.
Probably, yeah.
But until you actually see the Eric Rohmer film, unless you're familiar already, of course, if you watch Eric Rohmer films, you understand why, how these things happen, because they were unbelievably beautiful films.
Yeah, and actually unbelievably profound films. I had to watch these films several times for creating the materials that we released. So I had to proof the materials several times on different media. And each time I watched these, I saw new things, different things, and an increased depth in the films, both A Summer's Tale and A Tale of Winter. So even though I was a great fan of the films before, which is why I picked them up, I'm even more of a fan of them now after seeing them again and releasing them.
That's great. And then I guess that's related to the reason why you're in this game in the first place, is that, I don't know, the transcendent nature of watching film and what it can mean. You know?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And how it can transform from one viewing to another. I think the same applies to the films of Tsai Ming-Liang, especially when they're seen, when we don't have to wait years between them, when there's an opportunity like this with the retrospective to see several of them in a short period of time. It's easy to detect certain themes and preoccupations of the director, and stylistic elements, of course, too. The rain and water everywhere, urban alienation, and in Li Kangsheng in every film. We also have another film coming out on Tuesday, and it's what I would consider Denis Côté's masterpiece called Curling. The few people who know Denis Côté know him from Bestiaire and Vic and Flo Saw a Bear, but to me, I still think this is his best film. It's his most accessible film, and it's his most satisfying at the same time.
You're distributing the
DVD, the DVD, but also on VOD. It's already on iTunes. It came out on last Tuesday on iTunes, and will be on DVD Tuesday the 14th. And if you see the trailer, I think it's completely fascinating and intriguing just from the trailer. It's a really great trailer, which I can't say I made. The producers made it, but it's a great. It really sells the film, I believe, and really. Draws you into it, and that the film is everything that's in the trailer and more. So I would encourage people to take a look at that.
Where can people find out more about Big World?
We have a website, bigworldpictures.org. We also have a Facebook page, which is Big World Pix, P-I-X, because there was another Big World Pictures prior to us, producer of biker exploitation flicks. And every now and then we get our wires crossed, and IMDb will put Frankenstein created bikers attributed to us, and Dear God, No, that's the film they're working on right now, I believe.
Well, unfortunately, they're not a non-profit, so you can't really merge, but it would have been a good idea otherwise. Thank you, Jonathan. Let's do it again for a longer conversation. We could just talk films next time.
Great. Okay, fantastic. We'll do. Thank you, Adam.
You know, of course, Nick Broomfield's made many, many, many very watchable films about documentaries, specifically about controversial figures. He made two films about the serial killer Eileen Wuornos, which are amazing, right through her execution. He made films about the relationship of Kurt and Cobain and Courtney Love. And it's sort of topical again because there's a new documentary out about Kurt Cobain, which is executive produced by his daughter, Frances Bean. In fact, I think it opens today as well, Friday. Anyway, he's made a film about, Sarah Palin called You Betcha. He's made films about Heidi Fleiss, Hollywood Madam. He's made films about Biggie and Tupac and many others. So this latest one is about another serial killer, actually. He returns to that subject. This one's named Lonnie Franklin Jr., and he was arrested back in 2010 after a 25-year killing spree, apparently. And the reason why he got away with it so much, according to the film and the theory behind this film, and Well, it's not so much a theory if you think about it, because for 25 years he was killing poor black women, often prostitutes, addicts, and not entirely, by the way, but because they were black and poor, usually, or middle class, they went missing, but nobody really investigated the string of missing women to the degree that this serial killer was caught, until a certain point anyway. So this documentary by Nick Broomfield digs into the subject matter of how this could have happened, about the state of South Central LA, the apartheid bifurcation of the wealth and the poverty that still exists, the extremes of Los Angeles and of race still, and how it's still a huge topic that we're barely scratching the surface of. Some of these recent cases of abuse by police certainly have started a serious dialogue, which is, I guess, good news that's come out of otherwise some bad news. This is another angle on that story, too. It's all related. So here it is. This is a conversation with the filmmaker Nick Broomfield. Again, Tales of the Grim Sleeper broadcast premiere on HBO April 27th. So do check it out.
Why didn't they tell the community that there was someone running around killing girls?
They said, he's only killing hookers.
You get this car? You ain't coming out. You ain't coming unless you're dead.
Lonnie's a good guy. What do you want? What do you want to know? Lonnie was a good guy.
In the eyes of his neighbors.
And this is a close-knit block?
This is a close block.
Very close-knit.
And if you ever need anything, you just tell him, and he'll get it for you. Don't ask questions. Just know he got it for you. However he got it, we never knew.
He did not steal cars. He dealt in stolen cars.
He was heavily into women.
So what? He was into women. A lot of people into women. What do? Go to the police and say, hey, this man into women.
Before Lonnie Franklin's arrest, many people in the community believed the police themselves were involved. A police officer, Ricky Ross, was arrested for the murders, but released for lack of evidence.
Hi, Adam.
Hi.
We've met before. I think it was a number of years ago, and I'm trying to remember which film. I think it was the fiction film you did, the narrative.
Haditha.
Haditha, which I really liked.
Yeah.
Which we met at Film Forum, and it was
right.
You and the... No, I'm not going to remember. The soldier actor...
Elliot.
Are you still in touch with Elliot?
Yes, I am. I am, actually.
Are you?
He's not really acting anymore. He's,
wasn't.
What? Yes, he's, he's got, you know, family and stuff now.
Yeah, one can get busy. Well, it's good he has his, he always seemed like a stand-up guy, as we say, you know. But this is Tales of the Grim Sleeper.
Grim Sleeper, yeah.
Yeah, which I saw at the New York Film Festival, I guess the press screening, and you had Pam with you there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Pam
Brooks, by the way,
one of the main characters.
Yeah. Main characters in the film. And how was that? How was, for her, I always imagine it's kind of a surreal thing for somebody who lives an entire, several lives even maybe, like Pam. She lived quite a dramatic life and then cleans up, I suppose, and then just happens through, you know, circumstances, find herself one of the subjects of a documentary. This one about Lonnie Franklin, who was a serial killer in South Central L.A. She was able to help connect you with a lot of people that knew Lonnie really well, right?
And
right
kind of into I think the thing with someone like Pam, who, Pam, we fortunately met just very early on in the film when we were starting.
Mm-hmm.
And she took us around the community and knew a lot of the women still working on the streets, many of whom sleeping pretty rough because they're on crack and... Pam was on crack, too. She's now, I think, 4 years sober last week. And she was kind of our guide around South Central. I think it's been strange for her to be in the film, partly because I think everyone in the community suddenly imagines she's now getting lots of money, which, of course, is not the case. And... Pam's problems of paying the rent every month are still there. And, you know, one of the ironies is that we were able to work with Pam for months and months and months. She was completely reliable, highly intelligent, wonderful human being, and she still can't get a decent job. And this is partly because she got a felony conviction for possession of crack. As you know, possession of cocaine has had a much lower sentence, but crack was all
understand. It was much more stigmatic, and it was it was something that the Republicans could grab onto and exploit people's fears about it, and then get.
It's exactly what happened, and then disenfranchise them. So a lot of the people, you know, including Pam, don't have the vote. So one of the things we've been trying to do actually is to get Pam a regular income, and you know, I think she's so charismatic. She obviously got through her crack addiction, and one of the problems is if there were at least some programs in South Central helping people get off crack addiction, Pam, I'm sure, would make a fantastic counselor. She's trained as a healthcare worker, but they're so badly paid that even though she's got three different jobs looking after people, she still barely can make the rent every month.
We call that being underemployed now. We have a term for it. And it's a chronic problem. I understand it. And it's an interesting other point you made, which is the perception in her community that she probably got a bunch of money because it's Hollywood.
Yeah, it's Hollywood.
It's the furthest thing from Hollywood. Yeah. Of course, we know that, but most people don't.
But I think that's been quite difficult for Pam.
So it's kind of ostracized her a little bit?
Well, I wouldn't say ostracized her, and I don't think she, you know, she's a strong person.
Right.
So I don't think she really cares, but.
Well, that's good.
I think, you know, her ex-husband, who probably likes to feel he controls her, has been a bit jealous and a bit difficult. And I think it's a community that is so ostracized from the rest of Los Angeles in a more or less an apartheid system that operates in Los Angeles that I think Pam is seen as somehow collaborating with the enemy a bit. You know, she's dealing with white Los Angeles, and no one else in the community is, which is obviously a situation that shouldn't exist at all, but it does, and it's until it gets resolved in a kind of an efficient way, which is you obviously can't have a town functioning efficiently that has an apartheid system in it. But I think the exciting thing about the film is that we are starting discussions, using the film to start discussions between the community. Garcetti, the mayor, is going to see the film. Herb Wesson, the president of the council, is seeing the film. The LAPD all came and saw it. I'm not sure that there'll be an enormous change from within the LAPD, but I think there's a lot of pressure on people, the new mayor and so on, to be seen to be doing something, because there's more or less been a genocide there. There's probably between 400 and 500 women have disappeared over a 30-year period. No one knows where they are. And they were written off as sort of crack addicts and so on. But this is obviously a completely untenable situation. I mean, even in a banana republic, there would be eyebrows raised and so on. But this is in the center of Los Angeles. So I think people need to be seen to be doing something, people in power. And HBO are showing the film, which actually gives them all a bit of time to say, well, actually, we've started doing this and we're starting to do that. So we're using the film very much to start those discussions off.
Almost it almost is getting a institutional distribution within of sorts within.
Yes.
Well, maybe it wasn't quite as planned out or it wasn't part of your strategy, but it's a nice outcome, certainly, if you can start the conversation, if not actually make some changes. It's a huge, as you said, endemic kind of issue.
Yeah.
The amount of this kind of entrenched institutional racism that goes on. I mean, one who is not that paranoid could argue that the crack epidemic was, if not created, it was certainly ignored at the very best.
Well, and it's gone on for a long time.
Yeah. And it's still, I think the perception is, oh, that's not a problem. That's an 80s, 90s problem.
Yeah, and
but
of course it's
30 years later.
It's continued on. I mean, there are obviously a lot of questions as to how the crack got into South Central.
Well, that's what I,
But the big problem has been that there has been no systematic approach to the community, which has been completely torn apart by this epidemic, which still rages in South Central. And it's been very much treated as an individual problem. Like, oh, you know, you have a problem because you're on crack, rather than actually everyone in your street and all the other streets around you is on crack. And there isn't a single family that hasn't lost a family member to it one way or another, or been torn apart by it. And it really needs a systematic approach to that.
Right. At what point do you say, okay, it's their fault. Now what? You know, if that's what you need to say or believe, then fine. But then let's move on. I mean, it was still eating away at – think of how much – greater LA could be for everybody if some of these issues were.
Well, one of the ironies too is that if you have a felony conviction for possession of crack or crack addiction, you then aren't eligible for a number of the programs that would get you off crack. So it's a ridiculous sort of catch-22 situation.
Right, but if you don't have if you haven't been arrested for crack, you're fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and so I was trying to for a moment. When you talked about Pam's post-production life, post-film, and I was wondering, I think just having seen you speak a bunch over the years would naturally feel responsibility to remain in touch with, not, well, you mentioned even Elliot, but with Pam, whose circumstances are a bit much more, you know, fragile. And so, because you kind of brought her into the car. For instance, and so she was visible to everybody. So I understand. So that's part of your commitment, right? And
well, I think, but it's also must be a real friendship developed between us and
her and Barney too, right?
Yeah, Barney, my son, who shot the film. They have a very close relationship, probably closer than the relationship I have with Pam. I think Pam and Barney have a lot of fun. They're both mad backgammon players, and they can gamble over nothing. I mean, and of course, they have an ongoing thing as to who cheated in what game. So they're as thick as thieves, the two of them, and have a delightful relationship. So I think that will continue on. And it's always been a joy to me making these documentaries, is that you meet amazing people that you wouldn't meet otherwise, and you have fantastic friendships with them that endure for years and years and years.
Even though the film, actually several of your films where you put yourself sort of in what appears to be peril, some peril or some level of tension anyway, you know, there's some moments when you're approaching, for instance, getting back to the main subject of the film, which is the serial killer, Lonnie Franklin.
Yeah.
I don't want to say Lonnie Davis. Somebody famous, a singer.
Lonnie Safer.
Lonnie. And his son, whose name is Christopher. Mm. At first, you build a tension there. You're not sure what Christopher's about. We see him from a distance. He's lurking in his backyard. Mm. The way the film is edited until we actually sit and meet. And even then, he's menacing, let's face it. But we're not sure what his reaction. You're kind of there. You're within, let's say, gunfire range.
Definitely.
And you also always remain very calm character throughout, as you do through a lot of the films where you do this, maybe Biggie and Tupac kind of thing. There's many others where you've done this. I mean, but maybe even Sarah Palin, you betcha, you were around a lot of Tea Party folks, weren't you?
Yeah.
That's could be very...
They are enough to make you agitated, though.
You betcha. Yeah. I just posted another video, and I was in a group situation or something, and I had to play... It was a new Sarah Palin video, and they're horrifying and priceless. But anyway, my point, if there was one, your presentation of yourself it adds a little lightness to it and a kind of almost a humor to it. Is that intentional, first of all, that here's this Englishman in South Central, kind of the fish out of water?
I think the role of the outsider is always potentially amusing. And I've always seen myself more as a Clouseau character, probably.
That's... Fair.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think you can bring in a humor because of your interaction with people, and you can bring their humanity out too, with your friendship with them, which I think is something that doesn't, is that you? I hope so.
Embarrassed. Yeah. I thought I turned that off.
which doesn't happen without it. I think, the challenge in documentary is to inform, but also entertain and have a gripping narrative. You need all those things, really. And sometimes it's useful to have me. There's not much of me really in this film because the people are so powerful and they're so articulate and they, no one can state their case better than them. I think in films like Sarah Palin or some of the other ones I've done where basically the central character doesn't want to cooperate with the film, doesn't want to be in the film, it's useful to have oneself in there as a device to tell a narrative. But it's much better if you don't have to, I think.
Also, I think over time, I mean, some of the lighter moments were with Pam and just how you played off each other and you know, and that she seemed very, very engaged and amused by you and this budding friendship. So it's a nice yes. thing to witness. Also,
yeah, I think
around a very disturbing story.
It's very,
yeah.
It was light and funny.
Did you, as you were watching it, what were you thinking as you were in the edit, maybe post-production, and you're watching this as maybe with a different perspective slightly?
I think in some of the earlier cuts, probably there wasn't so much of Pam. And I noticed that whenever there was Pam, particularly if I showed the film to people who weren't involved with it, they all just loved Pam. They all wanted more and more of Pam. Because I think, in a way, our relationship with Pam was kind of the relationship they could imagine having as well. So it was a way of them kind of getting into the film. Mm-hmm. And let's face it, some of the film is quite hard-hitting. It takes one into a area where a lot of people in Los Angeles haven't been and are frightened to go. And Pam is somebody who is so approachable and so has such a big heart and is such an optimistic person mm-hmm. that she is completely engaging for an audience.
Yeah, I think one of the exciting things in the film was the stripping away of layers of defensiveness that we see with a number of the subjects of the film. There's three guys. They're very, very strong characters also. I mean, that's the beauty of it is the three of his neighbors who are very defensive initially.
Right.
Right. And then we see what's beautiful is we can then identify with them. And of course, that is also a very effective way of breaking down barriers and getting rid of that fear that you mentioned.
They we call them the Three Stooges.
Yeah.
They were initially.
They know that?
not necessarily. It was Steve, Richard, and Gary. And we met them on the first day of filming, and Steve had been calling me Peckerwood. And I guess it was pretty understandable. It was like all these sort of white film crews that come down there to ask questions about the worst thing that's ever happened in the street, which is about their friend Lonnie Franklin. And so they were defensive on his behalf. He was a very popular person in the neighborhood. He employed a lot of people in his sort of car business one way or another in an area where there were very few jobs. So they were quite loyal to Lonnie, and he also was the local fence who could get cheap washing machines and all that sort of thing. So initially they said, you know, he's innocent. He's been painted as the Grim Sleeper by the press. This is inaccurate. We don't see this in him and so on. They were very defensive. Mm-hmm. And then over the next few weeks, I think they all started, partly because of the film, examining their role and their friendship with Lonnie. And individually, they all came forward and said, well, maybe I remember this incident with him, or I remember seeing that. And they came up with these rather astonishing stories, which very much pointed to Lonnie Franklin's guilt. And also painted a very complicated portrait of a community that is so cut off from the rest of Los Angeles that there's really no trust, for example, with the police. The police are really perceived as the enemy who will arrest you, really with, and even if you go to the police with information, they're more likely to use it against you and lend you in trouble. And so I think although a lot of the people were aware of, and certainly Gary, Richard, and Steve were aware of things that weren't right about Lonnie, the last thing they would do is go to the police and say anything. Mm-hmm. And then you realize, too, that the police kind of not only dropped the ball, but had various slang words like NHI.
Non-human involved.
Yeah, no human involved.
No human, which referred to prostitutes, gang members, and drug addicts.
Whose bodies were found, they would just call them in as NHI.
Right.
Which meant that there wasn't really proper forensics and so on done on the bodies.
It must be quite a method, too, on some darker or psychological level for a police officer to dehumanize so many people. It makes it maybe easier to sort of get through the night. I sleep through the night. I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
I think from that point of view, it's like these people are constantly causing us trouble. We're arresting the same people week after week.
Well, they wouldn't have a job. they didn't have any problems.
Well, I guess I think they see themselves as serving the taxpaying citizens and not these sort of people. And actually, when we met Lonnie Franklin's son, Christopher, one of the first things he said to us, just completely out of the blue, was, "My father had a lot of fans in law enforcement, and when they heard I was his son, they would come up to me and say, 'Wow, you're the son of the Grim Sleeper. Can we shake your hand?'" And there was a kind of feeling that Christopher said was that Lonnie was somehow helping them clean the streets with all the killings and murders that he'd done, which is kind of particularly horrifying.
If it's true, right? Because I absolutely believe
Christopher. Yeah, right. I don't think Christopher was even aware of the implications of what he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think he was just stating it. I don't think Christopher was trying to make a political point because he doesn't have that kind of consciousness. He's not a political animal. He's somebody who lives in South Central and.
Right. No, I'm just thinking, you know, it's not up to me to interpret it. I suppose it's take it on face value. So anyway, I guess to wrap up the synopsis, since we've kind of been leaking plot points throughout, but Lonnie had more murders than any other serial killer.
He's been charged with 20.
20, but maybe up to 100 or something.
Well, they found
200 or something. I don't know.
Pictures of 180 missing women.
Some of whom have been accounted for, but a lot of them are just on the streets and hard to find, right? But I think it's going to be a large number regardless.
Well, most of them have not been accounted for. And I think that there are probably, then of course there's the 20 on top of that who we know, or they found DNA specimens from Lonnie on their bodies. So, you know, a conservative estimate is that there's sort of probably 150 women that might be attributed to Lonnie or going up. And those are just the ones that they found the photographs of.
Right.
And then, of course, Lonnie drove a garbage truck around, and the feeling is a lot of the bodies are in landfill. So it's a pretty amazing situation.
But even though it was mentioned that they might have been many of them were prostitutes, they weren't all prostitutes. And even if that's beside the point, I suppose, anyways, because they're just people. Tales of the Grim Sleeper is going to be on HBO this late spring, early summer.
Late spring, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And are you based in the States and in the UK? How does that work?
I live in California and in the UK.
Okay.
So backwards and forwards. I mean, from the UK, but my eldest son went to school in, his mom is American. And I now
this is Joan Churchill?
Joan Churchill. Uh-huh. And I now have a younger son of two who's going to
you
school.
You do?
Yeah.
2 years old?
2 years old.
Okay. I won't ask how that happened.
It happened the normal way.
It's normal. Two.
The human reproductive system.
Yeah.
He's two. He's called Charlie. Uh-huh. And he lives and his mom live in California too. So spent quite a lot of time there.
Yeah, I bet. Because it seems like your documentaries, anyway, are all, by and large, take place in their American stories.
A lot of them are American stories, which I did the last one I did before this was a British story.
Which one was that?
It was called Sex, My British Job. And it was a sort of undercover film, which I wasn't that involved with, where a Chinese journalist called Xiao Hong Pei went into a Chinese brothel in London and worked as a maid there for a few weeks and filmed it all with these sort of spy glasses.
Oh, okay.
It was kind of an exercise to see, you know, what one could do. It, you know, it was a bit of a failed film in some ways. I mean, Shao had a kind of nervous breakdown while she was doing the film. So although that was very revealing, it was a very frustrating film to work on for one reason or another.
They all seem to have that potential because
all the films do. Well, yes,
that's
do.
Part of the.
It's part of the documentary
but,
thing.
But that's part of your particular style and the method.
I guess so. Yes, I think what I love about documentary is that it is a voyage into the unknown, and it's about spontaneity, and it's about using a kind of reality. The story that reality presents you is the film, rather than going in with a script and getting people to say what fits in with your thesis and script. I think that's a kind of very uninteresting use of the potential of documentary. And a lot of films now are made that way. Filmmakers research them exhaustively, and then they go and make that film. And I think part of the problem is that in these sort of pitch forums and stuff, you're expected to be able to talk about your three-act structure and your resolution, which I personally think in a documentary is ridiculous. But
well, there's no economy for very few filmmakers. There's no economy. It's not possible to go that more organic route where a film, let's say, could be, you know, 5 years. It could be 10 years. You don't know how the story's going to unfold, and you kind of might have to stick with the story. Now, I'm sure many of those filmmakers are also doing other projects or other jobs concurrently with that, but... So, I mean, there's no economic incentive to go on. But your films seem to run a couple of years, I mean, in between. And
well,
then,
normally
you know,
quicker.
Could
normally
go.
Quicker.
Yeah.
This one was a couple of years, but most of them I've done within a year.
Right, which is not typical. I mean, yeah. I just want to mention also Frederick Wiseman, who I talked to recently, and I know is an old hero of yours. But he when he did Law and Order, which was a documentary going back some time, I don't remember what he was like.
Which I've seen.
He tried to do that in L.A. first, and I guess because they didn't have a beat, a sidewalk. They didn't, you know, they didn't walk the street. They were completely in patrol cars, and he didn't want that. He wanted to be on the streets with the officers, so he abandoned L.A., And then he went to like Kansas City or somewhere where the or Baltimore or something like that where they said that, you know, he was free to, you know, they did have street beat so he could walk around with them.
Fred Wiseman is an example of somebody who does one film a year.
Very true. Yeah. Even if it's a few years in between.
High Water.
Did you see National Gallery yet?
Yes, I have.
Oh, you have?
Fantastic.
It was beautiful, right? Yeah. And you understand why they have to be as long as they are too, because you can't really get what you get from the end of sitting there for 2 or 3 hours or 4 hours. With seeing something in 80 minutes for his thing, it just wouldn't work. You wouldn't get the sense of what he's doing. Well, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
And I hope we could do it again, maybe in the spring or something when you're back or something.
That would be great.
Thanks, Nick. Appreciate it.
Very sorry again.
Oh, don't be sorry. That's fine. Cheatin', and that's with the apostrophe after the N, it's another very specific type of cartoon film. It's about a newlywed wife who proves the depth of her love by becoming her cheating husband's mistresses. There's a special machine, I guess, you can get at Target or someplace like that, and she's made it happen. But you can't really describe the film. You just have to see the works of Bill Plimpton. He's currently on a mad rush across the country, making appearances because he's a very popular guy. He's but much beloved. There's a big Bill Plimpton fan base out there, and he's meeting everybody. And it's going to all wind down. His film is also now available on Vimeo On Demand. Here's my conversation with Bill Plimpton.
Thank you. What's the name of your show?
Film Wax. Film Wax Radio. Okay. It started kind of in the internet radio. And then I just podcasted, and then I thought, what am I doing? I may as well just, you know, for those interested in listening, sure. Podcast is enough nowadays. It's a real thing now.
Yeah.
Well, it's good to meet you, Bill.
Likewise.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I watched Cheating. Now, is there an apostrophe at the end of that?
There is.
Technically? Okay. Yeah.
It's doesn't... like your cheating heart.
Yeah. No, I figured.
It's a very right. kind of
It's very down, specific.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Down home kind of cheating. It's not a fancy,
right.
Elegant, aristocratic cheating.
Yeah.
It's a real sleazy, easy motel, you know,
yeah.
Hank Williams kind of thing.
Gotcha. Yeah. And it is about, I guess it deals with infidelity, and but it's just sexy, and it's not typical animated film.
Well,
anymore.
We say that this mm-hmm. film would make Walt Disney roll over in his freezer.
Yeah.
Because it's definitely not your typical kiddie fairy tale film.
Mm-hmm.
It does have some fantasy parts to it, obviously,
right.
which is what animation is so great at.
Right.
But there is nudity. Uh-huh. There is violence. There is a lot of surrealism and emotion, deep emotions and deep psychological angst. And so that's why I say it's not a kiddie film.
Yeah.
Don't bring your kids to this.
You're not reacting. It's just a story you wanted to tell, right? It wasn't. You weren't.
Well, that's what pisses me off is that
yeah, I know.
Animation is somehow been stereotyped as a kiddie medium when people, adults, don't get a chance to enjoy it.
Right.
For some reason, it's verboten for older people to enjoy animation speaking about their issues. And all the issues that are in animation are fairy tales and happy little toys that sing. And I just think that's a crime.
And by the way, you say it's for adults, but I would even say that the kids don't even know what they're missing at all. I mean, maybe not cheating in particular mm-hmm. because that's, you know, it's quite mature and very, you know, there is a graphic sex mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. But also, I grew up with watching other types of what would now be considered... It was certainly nothing that would be the, you know, a little bit more mature than like Disney fodder, you know. Mm-hmm, but we didn't mm-hmm. have, when you and I were kids and growing up, we didn't have the Pixars and
right. There wasn't
a children's industry.
No, there was totally
In the movies.
Disney totally dominated
there weren't
animation.
That many, though.
There weren't that many. That's correct. Yeah. Not like today.
Yeah,
there's almost an animated feature every month. Yeah. But there were adult animation feature films, Ralph Bakshi, of course, as
right.
you probably know. And then Japanese animation does deal with adult topics, but that's hard to get major distribution here. And, of course, some European films deal with adult ideas and adult topics. And, again, it's hard to get distribution here. So that's why I'm hoping that this film, Cheatin', does find an audience, does show people that there are alternatives to the Pixar, Disney, DreamWorks axis. And I think people want to see something different. They want to see something they've never seen before. And they want to see their lives portrayed in cartoons, which mm-hmm. is very rare. I know I have a lot of people who are friends or who work at Pixar, and they have affairs, they have adult ideas, they have emotions, divorces, things like that, but they're not allowed to talk about it. They're not allowed to make
films right?
about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, you tell stories or right, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
They can only talk about kiddie
themes,
plots.
And that kind of thing.
Yeah, and it just seems like they're not true artists. They're basically, you know, prostitutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And working for the producer, the distributor, who says, no, you can't talk about adult ideas.
Yeah, I remember hearing you talk about at one point, I guess earlier on in your career, when mm-hmm. I guess you had some success. You were in a successful trajectory, which continues, by the way, to this day.
Thank you.
And you were approached by Disney,
right?
Weren't you? And
yes.
They kind of, you know, the deal was proffered. And that had to be a real difficult choice to make on some level.
It was.
Because this was what you grew up with, right?
Yeah. I loved Disney as a kid. I still love Disney. I love their films. I love How to Train Your Dragon, I think, is a fabulous film. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a wonderful film. I wish I was a kid and saw that film as a 9-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. I would have just freaked out. But I still like it. And they do wonderful films. I'm not begrudging that. I just wish there was more variety in what they show. There was more adult ideas and more different kinds of techniques, different kinds of directors. And
other formulas.
Yes.
There's like one it. Seems to be other one a one formula that's permeating the current children's animation genre, right? Mm-hmm. And you can kind of see how things are going to unfold, and you kind of know the structure the moment you walk in. Kids seem to kind of not be too bored. They keep, but they have the capacity to see this even the same movie over and over, yes. Let alone see variations on the same theme, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not so surprising. What's your earliest memory of animation?
Well, I think it was probably Mickey Mouse on TV, yeah. Walt Disney's. I think Dumbo was probably the first film I saw, and mm-hmm. that was on TV. The first film animated film I saw in a movie theater was Sleeping Beauty. And that was, late 50s, 58, 59, something like that.
Wow.
But I do have wonderful memories of Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck on television. And one, just realizing how funny that is and how I wish I could make people laugh like those characters did. And that's what I'm doing today.
Yeah. I even knew as a kid that there's something very, very subversive about Bugs Bunny. You know, mm-hmm. as funny on a very, cosmetic level or on a very basic level, Bugs Bunny was just very funny, drawn funny, doing funny bits. But there was something very subversive also, like he was sort of like Groucho.
Yeah.
You know, the cartoon world. Did you wonder who was drawing these guys, like Chuck Jones? And
no, I didn't. I didn't really care that much.
No?
When I was young. I mean, obviously, when I got older, then I started to learn about Tex Avery, and I started to learn about Bob Clampett and Chuck Jones. I never was a huge Chuck Jones fan, although a couple of his films, I think, are classics. Mm-hmm. But I like the more surreal Tex Avery and the surreal Bob Clampett. They really pushed the artistic limits of what a cartoon is, and they were more artists than they were just humorous, and that's why I loved them, because they really stretched the imagination much more than Chuck Jones did.
What was Bob and Tex, what were their signature
characters? Tex Avery did the little Red Hot Riding Hood and all those really sexy dancing girls and rural Riding Hood and Deputy Droopy and all these really crazy violent films, which I thought were hilarious. And Bob Clampett did Cole White and the Seven Dwarfs, which is
what was it called?
Cole White and the Seven Dwarfs. Is that right? Cole Black. Thank you, John. Cole Black and the Seven Dwarfs, which was
say it one more time, though.
Oh, Cole Black and the Seben, S-E-B-E-N, Dwarves.
Okay, thanks for clarifying.
I think that's how it goes. And this one really stretched the limits of human draftsmanship. And using jazz music as it should be. Really wild and raucous and, you know, Fats Waller kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it was really probably one of the most mind-blowing films I've ever seen at a young age. So those are two of my heroes, plus Disney.
Yes.
But not only those guys, but also a lot of the cartoon artists, people like Charles Adams.
Mm-hmm. Oh, of course.
Who did a lot of cartoons that made fun of pain and death and suffering. And I always thought that was kind of forbidden to use that kind of subject matter as humor. But he really developed the black humor vein that is so strong now in America. But back when he was doing it in the 30s and 40s,
he was like the only guy.
He was the only guy, yeah. And he was really very popular, which is good. So that's why I do a lot of black humor stuff.
Yeah. Speaking of which, you mentioned Dumbo before and the Addams Family, of mm-hmm. course. What do you make of Tim Burton? He did, of course, the first Addams Family movie, maybe the second one too, I don't know.
Yeah.
And now he's doing a live-action Dumbo.
I saw that, yeah. I'm a big fan of Tim Burton, so I tried to emulate him, actually.
How so?
Well, he was a big success in animation, and then he did live action, Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Oh, sure, right.
Or Pee-wee's Big Circus, or I forget what it was.
Yeah, the first movie, Pee-wee's Playhouse. Was it the
Big adventure. Thank you, John.
John, come on over. I can use you too. General, if you could travel with me, that would be good because my memory is.
And he was a big success. And I thought, wow, if he can go from animation to live action, I should try it. And so I did 3 live action films.
You did.
And they were total bombs. They were not successful at all. So I respect what Tim can do, and I remained to make animation.
Have you given up on then live action then? Or do you
well,
feel
not
like,
really,
because like
I'm doing a live action film right now
called
Hitler's Folly, and it's a mockumentary about Adolf Hitler's alternate life as an animator and cartoonist.
Okay. I've heard rumors to effect, but now you're substantiating. Yeah. Finally, the truth comes out.
Yeah, the truth comes out.
And that bastard Tim Burton hadn't gotten his hands on this story, because it does sound like something. So just so I know, when did you first get the inkling? Because, you know, I'm going to guess when you were turning your attention to making animation, that the golden age was long past at that point of animation.
That's true.
And this was also well before the Renaissance, beginning with Pixar and the early return of Disney with the Lion King and all that, and the Beauty and the Beast. So in between, though, was kind of there were things. I remember some animated rock kind of stuff, and there was dreamy, trippy stuff coming out, but not too much.
I'll tell you what happened. I was graduated from college,
which was where?
Design Portland State in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And animation was dead then. I mean, Disney had died, and the studio was going bankrupt. Warner Brothers had closed down their animation studios. Fleischer Brothers was long gone. The only thing going on was Hanna-Barbera, and I hated Hanna-Barbera. Mm-hmm. So I decided to move to New York City and become an illustrator, because that was the only option open to me. So I was somewhat successful, but I really wanted to get back in animation. I really wanted to pursue my animation dreams. And so I made a funny film in 1987 called Your Face.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, it was a big success. Got nominated for an Oscar. It got bought by MTV. And as you said very well, this was the beginning of the second golden age of animation, the mid-80s. This is when MTV was starting to show animation, Liquid Television and Aeon Flux and things that.
Of course.
Japanese animation was starting to come in with Akira. Disney had started to bring back the animation with Jeffrey Katzenberg and Michael Eisner, and their film A Little Mermaid was a huge hit.
Right.
And they were shocked by how much money they did with that. And also Roger Rabbit was a giant hit. So all the big studios started realizing, wait, you know, we should hire back all these animators. We got people want to see animation again. And so I just sort of timed it. Luckily, starting my career in animation when the second golden age was really picking up. And then, as you said, you know, The Lion King and Beauty and the Beast, and then all the Pixar stuff comes in. It just grows and grows and grows. And now it's so big that oftentimes there'll be 4 animated films in the top 10 of that year. Mm-hmm. And who would have known? I mean, who would have guessed 50 years ago that animation would be back so big and so powerful and so dominant?
Right, where like, I guess the Lego Movie and
How to Train Dragon is one of my favorites. It's really great. Yeah.
Did you see the Lego? I guess you try to.
I did. Yes.
I
try to see all of them. Yeah.
All of them.
Yeah.
It can be painstaking at times.
Not at all. No, I love watching animation. Yeah. I told you, I love Disney. I love DreamWorks.
I know. Don't worry.
I just wish they did more interesting stuff.
Yeah.
More of a variety.
Right. Well, then.
That's my complaint.
Right. So how do you keep your style? I mean, for those who are listening, you have, at least historically, hand-illustrated your features, your animated features, solely by yourself until this time. You have some help. I understand.
No, who told you this?
I thought you had some help.
Where does this get out? I don't know. People,
I'm making it
that.
Up as I go along, Bill.
People come to the theater and they say, "So, Bill, you do the extremes. How many people do you have do the in betweens?" I say, "No. Where did you learn this?"
I thought maybe coloring. I don't even know.
I have people coloring.
Yeah,
that's true.
That's what I mean.
10 people for cheating did the color. It's all digital. It's all digital color. It's not hand colored.
Okay.
Although it looks like it.
Sure does.
But I've always done my own animation. With Hair High, I actually experimented for 1 week with hiring in-betweeners, and it was a complete disaster. Disaster. They charged a lot of money. They were very slow. They couldn't match my style. I said, I'd rather do it myself. It's much faster.
Yeah.
So I continued to do all my backgrounds, and I do all the animation. Every drawing you see on the screen, every little etch of pencil you see on the screen is created by my hand.
And so how long did it take to make like a film like Cheatin'?
Well, Cheatin' took about 3 years. It was a year to do pre-production, doing the story, the layouts, the storyboards, then a year for animation, and then a year for post-production, putting the sound and the editing and the music and all that sort of stuff. So about 3 years, maybe a little bit more.
I noticed you cast a friend of mine, or whoever casted it, cast a friend of mine, as Ella in Cheatin'.
Who's that?
Sophia.
I have yet to meet her.
You never met her.
I heard she's a movie star.
Well, that's a really... She's done quite a few films now, but independent films.
Uh-huh.
I've had her on here 3 times.
Wow.
3 times for 3
I never got
projects.
To meet her. I was never there for sound sessions. Weston Fonger hired her, and I trust his taste, and I think she probably came in for a couple hours and did some grunts and squeals.
Well, that's what it is. So talk about that, because that is another signature part of your filmmaking style is dialogue. It's a dialogue usually free.
Yes.
And where did that come from?
The film I did about 10 years ago was called Hair High, and Martha Plimpton, who's a relative of mine, obviously, brought in a lot of Hollywood stars to do the voices. It was very expensive, but I thought, wow, with these stars, I could get distribution, which is what I want.
Right,
so
of course.
So we had David Carradine and Keith Carradine and Sarah Silverman and Dermot Mulroney and, you know, all sorts of big-name people.
Sure.
And the film did not...
Didn't matter at all.
Yeah, people didn't care. So I said, well, I'm going the opposite way. I'm going very low budget, no dialogue, just sound effects and music, and just pencil on paper and kind of a monochromatic palette. And that film actually was a success.
But because you're not spending all the budget on high-profile actors, one thing.
Right.
Even if they're maybe charging you minimum. I mean, I can't imagine.
SAG minimum,
Yeah.
But still, I had, 15 actors, and they were really really good actors. I mean, I flew out to L.A. to do all these sessions. They're really top of the line. But it just seemed to me that, first of all, it's very slow and expensive to do lip sync. It's very hard for me to write dialogue. It's very expensive to sell the film to foreign territories when they have to do the dubbing or the subtitling or the intertitles. So, and also I just like the poetry of telling a story with just a face or a gesture or the music or the sound. And I like that kind of storytelling.
And there were a lot of cartoons. I remember growing up, there would occasionally just be silent cartoons. Well, silent in the dialogue sense, not in the music and all, that your film also has original scoring.
Well, a lot of the Warner Brothers and Chuck Jones films, too, had no dialogue. So,
right, a lot of that. Yeah, Roadrunner one certainly didn't have any dialogue.
Yeah, I love Roadrunner.
Yeah, me too. And so also through reading and watching you on other interviews, and I know that that distribution has always been one of the bigger, if not the biggest, headache. It's always like starting over each time. And
that's true.
And I know that one of your solutions or an option is putting it on Vimeo On Demand, for instance, and then you can play it off of your website, right, as well. Does that work for you?
Well, we haven't tried it yet.
So this is your first project going?
First time.
I know there's shorts of yours on there.
No, the shorts are all coming out on iTunes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I can't keep track of all the places that play my films, but as far as I know, we're scheduled to release Cheatin' on Vimeo On Demand on April 21st. As exclusive, and also I just signed a deal with Shorts International to sell my entire catalog to iTunes. I think it's this month they're released, and this is almost 15 hours of films.
Right.
And it's like 10 features or 9 features and almost 60 or 70 short films.
Wow.
So if you were around in the MTV era and you saw some film and you're a little stoned and you forgot what it was about,
yeah,
go to iTunes and you can see that film again in all its glory.
Smoking is optional.
Yeah. That's true. That's optional.
It just doesn't seem the same anymore. Watching iTunes and smoking doesn't seem to quite as romantic an idea as watching it, maybe getting stoned and then going to the movie theater or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I know that also critically your films have done very well because
the reviews for
festivals
Cheatin'
have done you've got some great festivals but Cheatin' got some great reviews and that's got to help and then also Idiots and Angels I remember mm-hmm. Saw that and that also seemed to be really well received. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes a much of a difference or not.
It does. Yeah. We love having great reviews. And we've won over 15 international awards for Cheatin', so it's a big success all over the world. But now we're concentrated on the U.S., and we're trying to get it out there in the U.S.
Yeah. So you've got a whole operation here.
Well, if you can call it that.
Here in the what did they call it? The old Flower District?
Yeah.
Chelsea.
Yeah, the Flower District. It's now Chelsea. Yeah. The flowers, there's only about 3 or 4 flower shops left.
I know. Yeah. But and so what goes on? Is it do you do other projects as well? I mean, you mentioned this one, the mockumentary that's coming up.
Well, I'm doing another exciting thing, and I'm glad you asked, is this film called Revengeance. And this is written by a wonderful animator named Jim Lujan, Lujan. And he's doing the voices and designing the characters and wrote the story, and I'm doing all the animation production. And the very exciting news is just yesterday we started our Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah, you're a very big fan of that.
Yes, we need that because it's hard to get Hollywood money to finance my film because it's not a typical Hollywood film. So I decided to go to the fans and get the money from them. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones who really love my films. They're the ones who support my films. It's a much more democratic way to do it. And it also leaves me the luxury of being completely independent. I don't have to worry about some marketing guy saying, you got to change that character, or you got to change that color, you got to finish it by this deadline.
And they're not expecting a return.
Yeah. Well, no, they do. They get cool stuff.
Well, they get cool stuff. They
do. One of the cool things that we're having here.
Yeah, tell about the prizes, though.
This is the neatest prize is if you donate a certain number, I remember how much, but I will draw your face and I will actually put you in the film as a character in the movie. So you will be immortalized in a Bill Plimpton film that you can tell your grandkids about. When they start getting excited about animation.
That's great. That might be the reason they get excited about animation.
Yeah, I hope so.
Their grandfather or mother.
John, what's the Kickstarter address?
Or what they search for when they go to Kickstarter.
Yeah, what do they search for?
Revengeance.
Okay.
Revengeance. So R-E-V-E-N-G-E or A-N-C-E? Revengance. Search Revengeance on Kickstarter. And I suppose there'll only be a handful of results. Probably just one. And then check out the prizes and hopefully.
Well, we're a third of the way done. I'm up to page 80 on the storyboards.
John, how many more days of that campaign? Now I feel like I can ask.
Yeah.
What day is that in?
It's May 21st, I believe.
Oh, good. So we have some time.
Yeah. 43 days to go.
Okay. Okay, May 21st is the...
don't wait till the last minute.
No.
Because my hand will be tired drawing everybody's caricature in the film, and then you won't get your picture in the film.
Right. But you must have cocktail napkins, and you scratch something on there and slow it down the list.
I do that. I have postcards, things like that.
That's good. So it's called Revengeance. So so the studio here is keeping real busy and keeping animation alive, or offering off the alternative from the great monolith. Is that the right word? No, that's not the right word. But the juggernaut.
Yeah.
That is the trifecta of the trifecta juggernaut of Disney, Pixar, and DreamWorks.
Yeah.
Are they separate? And Blue Sky. What did they make recently?
They made the Ice Age films.
Oh, okay.
They're making the Peanuts film, which I saw a clip of last week, and it looks pretty
interesting. We didn't even discuss Charles Schulz.
Yeah, Charles.
Didn't even occur to me. Mm-hmm. Was he ever? I remember getting those Peanuts books.
He wasn't one of my favorites. I don't actually. I never watched. I looked at a lot of comic strips when I was young.
Okay.
Again, it was always the Warner Brothers cartoons and the Disney cartoons. I never read Mad Magazine.
Yeah.
I liked it. Uh-huh. I thought it was neat, but it wasn't something that was...
That goes to a whole other category of illustrators, which, you know, people kind of sometimes, as probably I've been guilty of, putting him in the same world. But then folks like yourself have, or Charles, I don't know, Charles Adams actually probably never did do animation, right? He just stuck to illustration.
Correctly. Yeah, sadly. I mean, his stuff would be great animated.
Yeah, right. But there were a handful of these guys, right, that kind of went between the two worlds.
Yes, there were.
But obviously you mentioned Bakshi, who did Fritz the Cat,
right,
among other things, but that was had to be a very big influence.
That was one of the biggest grossing films of the year.
Yeah, I remember.
And the film was only about $2 million to make or something like that, very low budget. So he was the golden boy, and then he made a bunch of other films. It did all right, and then, I don't know, he just kind of lost his momentum and they weren't so good after a while.
Yeah. And I guess he was an illustrator too, but Crumb, right? He was involved in that. Did he create that character originally?
Yeah, Fritz the Cat, but he was he was really denouncing the film. The feature film, because he thought it really strayed away from his character, and maybe he was just a lot of sour grapes too, but he always denounced the film, and even though he signed a contract, he always regretted that and wished that the film would never have been made.
A lot of your work is available. And as you say, everything will be on iTunes.
Yes.
In a matter of...
Maybe as we speak.
As we speak.
I think it's on now.
Okay. And then, you can go to iTunes and see a lot of the Plimptoons. And then Cheatin' is currently in theaters in New York City.
Thank you, yes.
But... maybe not much longer. It's Wednesday.
The Village East is closing the 9th. Yeah, April 9th it closes. I'll be there.
Okay. You're going to be there to close?
I'll be there to close.
You're closing?
Yeah, very sad, yeah.
Shuttering.
But then I go on tour to, I think, a 15-city tour across America, promoting Cheatin' and
you're promoting Cheatin'.
Okay. Yeah. Meeting my fans and... Yeah. You know, trying to get awareness for the Vimeo On Demand release of the film.
Which I guess will happen while you're crossing the
country.
Exactly, because I can't imagine that's all going to happen on one or two Fridays, right?
Yeah. I think I'm going to be in L.A. We're going to have a special exclusive screening for special people on that date in Los Angeles.
Okay.
Vimeo's hosting this event, and we're trying to get a lot of celebrities there and people who love animation, and that'll be the sort of the kickoff, the launch of the Vimeo On Demand release.
I see. And who do you talk to over there, Jeremy or Boxer?
Jeremy, yeah, very good.
Yeah.
He's the man.
Yeah, he's been real busy.
Yeah.
And so it's good that they're reaching out to you and check out any of that High Maintenance series they put up there.
No, I did. Yeah, I did watch it. It's pretty wacky.
Yeah, you like wacky is the word, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Someone told me I should watch it, and I did, and it's not animation, so it's not really my cup of tea. But
it could
animate
it, though.
It could be animated. Yeah.
Right. I mean. Yeah. Do you know Kaveh Zahedi, the filmmaker? I recommend. He does really great stuff where he'll do. He's not an animator, but he often works. He's worked in the past with animators, and where he'll tell an audio story, and then they animate it, and it's really great. It works on it. Definitely, it's a nice.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. I'm glad they don't animate my podcast. But if they did, I guess I know where to go.
Tell people that if they want to find out more about my animation, go to plimptoons.com.
Plimptoons.com.
And they can see all of my stuff and find out what I'm doing, where my appearances are.
Keep up to date.
I'm going to, and if I'm coming to their town, they can come by and say hello.
That's fantastic. You mentioned you're related to Martha Plimpton.
Yes.
Who I actually have been, I guess, also been kind of pursuing very passive level to try to get on to come on to here too, because I love talking to actors who have had done so much work in the independent film world too.
Yeah, she's great.
So does that mean you're also related to George Plimpton?
Yep. But the,
and distantly, or
but
how does
Martha
that work?
And George are PLI Plimpton.
Okay.
I'm PLY.
Yeah, but you said
so their
your
side
house
of
that
the family is the Boston side, and the PLYs moved out to the West Coast.
Uh-huh.
This was about 200 years ago. They split up.
Oh, I see. But you know just through how that you're related then.
We used to have big Plimpton family reunions.
Oh.
And so I'd run into them all the time. Actually, I knew George before. I met him at some book party, and he took a liking to me, and was very, very helpful to me.
Was he?
Yeah, he's a very nice guy.
Well, he was in publishing, and you were probably trying to get published.
I did some books, and he wrote a nice introduction to one of my books. So.
Yeah. And I guess maybe your illustrations wouldn't have worked in the Paris Review, but
he never asked me.
No, it's interesting because I didn't put that together, the spelling. Yeah. But once you mentioned you were related, then I thought she was related somehow.
She's more closely related to George than to me.
All right, very good. Well, thank you so much. And again, I'm going to recommend Cheating to everybody I know.
Oh, super!
And seriously, on your next project, maybe we can do this again talk again.
Revengeance.
Yeah. All right. Great.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks, everybody. I'm going to duck out of here real fast because, I have to edit this show that I just finished recording and get it up and out to you and into the universe and still try to have a day here. So I'm going to skip the usual advertisements that I make and just thank you for listening and to subscribe, of course, on iTunes and spread the good word about what I'm doing. We so desperately do need the listeners. So thank you very much. My name is Adam Chartoff, the host of Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Thanks for listening. Until next time.
You're so in love, little girl. So much in love, little girl. Running around in circles, why? You know it's a crime. No less, no more.